And do you know what that man has been to me? 5 years ago, when Kuzma brought me here, I used to shut myself up, that no one might have sight or sound of me. I was a silly slip of a girl. I used to sit here sobbing. I used to lie awake all night, thinking, where is he now, the man who wronged me? He's laughing at me with another woman, most likely. If only I could see him. If I could meet him again, I'd pay him out. I'd pay him out. At night I used to lie sobbing into my pillow in the dark, and I used to brood over it. I used to tear my heart on purpose and gloss over my anger. I'll pay him out, I'll pay him out. That's what I used to cry out in the dark. And when I suddenly thought that I should really do nothing to him, and that he was laughing at me then, or perhaps had utterly forgotten me, I would fling myself on the floor, melt into helpless tears, and lie there shaking till dawn. In the morning I would get up more spiteful than a dog, ready to tear the whole world to pieces. And then, what do you think? I began saving money. I became hard-hearted, grew stout, grew wiser, would you say? No, no one in the world sees it, no one knows it. But when night comes on, I sometimes lie, as I did 5 years ago when I was a silly girl, clenching my teeth and crying all night, thinking, I'll pay him out, I'll pay him out. Do you hear? Well then, now you understand me. A month ago a letter came to me. He was coming, he was a widower, he wanted to see me. It took my breath away, then I suddenly thought, if he comes and whistles to call me, I shall creep back to him like a beaten dog. I couldn't believe myself. Am I so abject? Shall I run to him or not? And I've been in such a rage with myself all this month that I'm worse than I was 5 years ago. Do you see now, Alyosha, what a vile and vindictive creature I am? I've shown you the whole truth. I played with Mitya to keep me from running to that other. Hush, Rakitin, it's not for you to judge me. I'm not speaking to you. Before you came in, I was lying here waiting, brooding, deciding my whole future life, and you can never know what was in my heart. Yes, Alyosha, tell your young lady not to be angry with me for what happened the day before yesterday. Nobody in the whole world knows what I'm going through now, and no one can ever know. For perhaps I shall take a knife with me today. I can't make up my mind.
And at this tragic phrase, Grushenka broke down, hid her face in her hands, flung herself on the sofa pillows, and sobbed like a little child. Alyosha got up and went to Rakitin.
Misha, he said, don't be angry. She wounded you, but don't be angry. You heard what she said just now. You mustn't ask too much of human endurance. One must be merciful.
Alyosha said this at the instinctive prompting of his heart. He felt obliged to speak, and he turned to Rakitin. If Rakitin had not been there, he would have spoken to the air. But Rakitin looked at him ironically, and Alyosha stopped short.
You were so primed up with your elder's teaching last night that now you have to let it off on me, Alexei, man of God, said Rakitin with a smile of hatred.
Don't laugh, Rakitin, don't smile. Don't talk of the dead. He was better than anyone in the world, cried Alyosha with tears in his voice. I didn't speak to you as a judge, but as the lowest of the judged. What am I beside her? I came here seeking my ruin and said to myself, what does it matter in my cowardliness? But she, after 5 years in torment, as soon as anyone says a word from the heart to her, it makes her forget everything, forgive everything in her tears. The man who has wronged her has come back. He sends for her, and she forgives him everything and hastens joyfully to meet him. And she won't take a knife with her. She won't. No, I'm not like that. I don't know whether you are, Misha, but I'm not like that. It's a lesson to me. She is more loving than we. Have you heard her speak before of what she's just told us? No, you haven't. If you had, you'd have understood her long ago. And the person insulted the day before yesterday must forgive her too. She will, when she knows, and she shall know. This soul is not yet at peace with itself. One must be tender with it. There may be a treasure in that soul.
Alyosha stopped because he caught his breath. In spite of his ill humour, Rakitin looked at him with astonishment. He had never expected such a tirade from the gentle Alyosha.
She's found someone to plead her cause. Why, are you in love with her? Our good friend Alexandrovna, our monk's really in love with you. You've made a conquest," he cried with a coarse laugh.
Grushenka lifted her head from the pillow and looked at Alyosha with a tender smile shining on his tear-stained face.
"Let him alone, Alyosha, my cherub. You see what he is. He's not a person for you to speak to. Mikhail Ospovich," she turned to Rakitin, "I meant to beg your pardon for being rude to you, but now I don't want to. Alyosha, come to me. Sit down here."
She beckoned to him with a happy smile.
"That's right, sit here. Tell me."
She took him by the hand and peeped into his face, smiling.
"Tell me, do I love that man or not? The man who wronged me, do I love him or not? Before you came, I lay here in the dark asking my heart whether I loved him. Decide for me, Alyosha, the time has come, it shall be as you say. Am I to forgive him or not?"
"But you have forgiven him already," said Alyosha, smiling.
"Yes, I really have forgiven him,"
Grushenka murmured thoughtfully.
"What an abject heart. To my abject heart."
She snatched up a glass from the table, emptied it at a gulp, lifted it in the air and flung it on the floor. The glass broke with a crash. A little cruel line came into her smile.
"Perhaps I haven't forgiven him, though," she said with a sort of menace in her voice, and she dropped her eyes to the ground as though she were talking to herself. "Perhaps my heart is only getting ready to forgive. I shall struggle with my heart. You see, Alyosha, I've grown to love my tears in these 5 years. Perhaps I only love my resentment, not him."
"Well, I shouldn't care to be in his shoes," hissed Rakitin.
"Well, you won't be, Rakitin. You'll never be in his shoes. You shall black my shoes, Rakitin. That's the place you're fit for. You'll never get a woman like me.
And he won't either, perhaps."
"Won't he? Then why are you dressed up like that?"
said Rakitin with a venomous sneer.
"Don't taunt me with dressing up, Rakitin. You don't know all that is in my heart. If I choose to tear off my finery, I'll tear it off at once this minute," she cried in a resonant voice. "You don't know what that finery is for, Rakitin. Perhaps I shall see him and say, 'Have you ever seen me look like this before?' He left me a thin, consumptive crybaby of 17. I'll sit by him, fascinate him, and work him up. 'Do you see what I am like now?' I'll say to him. 'Well, and that's enough for you, my dear sir. There's many a slip 'twixt the cup and the lip.' That may be what the finery is for, Rakitin,"
Grushenka finished with a malicious laugh.
"I'm violent and resentful, Alyosha. I'll tear off my finery, I'll destroy my beauty, I'll scorch my face, slash it with a knife and turn beggar. If I choose, I won't go anywhere now to see anyone. If I choose, I'll send Kuzma back all he has ever given me tomorrow, and all his money, and I'll go out charring for the rest of my life. You think I wouldn't do it, Rakitin, that I would not dare do it? I would, I could do it directly, only don't exasperate me, and I'll send him about his business. I'll snap my fingers in his face. He shall never see me again."
She uttered the last words in an hysterical scream, but broke down again, hit her face in her hands, buried it in the pillow, and shook with sobs. Rakitin got up.
"It's time we were off," he said. "It's late. We should be shut out of the monastery."
Grushenka leapt up from her place.
"Surely you don't want to go, Alyosha," she cried in mournful surprise. "What are you doing to me? You've stirred up my feeling, tortured me, and now you'll leave me to face this night alone."
"He can hardly spend the night with you. Though if he wants to, let him. I'll go alone,"
Rakitin scoffed cheeringly.
"Hush, evil tongue,"
Grushenka cried angrily at him.
"You never said such words to me as he has come to say."
"What's he said to you so special?"
asked Rakitin irritably.
"I can't say, I don't know. I don't know what he said to me. It went straight to my heart. He has wrung my heart. He's the first, the only one who's pitied me. That's what it is. Why did you not come before, you angel? She fell on her knees before him as though in a sudden frenzy. "I've been waiting all my life for someone like you. I knew that someone like you would come and forgive me. I believed that, nasty as I am, someone would really love me, not only with a shameful love."
"What have I done to you?" answered Alyosha, bending over her with a tender smile and gently taking her by the hands. "I only gave you an onion. Nothing but a tiny little onion. That was all."
He was moved to tears himself as he said it. At that moment there was a sudden noise in the passage. Someone came into the hall. Grushenka jumped up, seeming greatly alarmed. Fenya ran noisily into the room, crying out, "Mistress, mistress, darling, a messenger has galloped up," she cried, breathless and joyful. "A carriage from Mokroe for you. Timofey, the driver, with three horses. They're just putting in fresh horses. A letter. Here's the letter, mistress."
A letter was in her hand, and she waved it in the air all the while she talked. Grushenka snatched the letter from her and carried it to the candle. It was only a note, a few lines. She read it in one instant.
"He has sent for me," she cried, her face white and distorted, with a wan smile. "He whistles. Crawl back, little dog."
But only for one instant she stood, as though hesitating. Suddenly the blood rushed to her head and sent a glow to her cheeks.
"I will go," she cried. 5 years in my life. Goodbye. Goodbye, Alyosha, my fate is sealed. Go, go. Leave me, all of you. Don't let me see you again. Grushenka is flying to a new life. Don't you remember evil against me either, Rakitin? I may be going to my death. Oh, I feel as though I were drunk.
She suddenly left them and ran into her bedroom.
"Well, she has no thoughts for us now," grumbled Rakitin. "Let's go, or we may hear that feminine shriek again. I'm sick of all these tears and cries."
Alyosha mechanically let himself be led out. In the yard stood a covered cart. Horses were being taken out of the shafts. Men were running to and fro with a lantern. Three fresh horses were being led in at the open gate. But when Alyosha and Rakitin reached the bottom of the steps, Grushenka's bedroom window was suddenly opened, and she called in a ringing voice after Alyosha.
"Alyosha, give my greetings to your brother Mitya, and tell him not to remember evil against me, though I have brought him misery. And tell him, too, in my words, Grushenka has fallen to a scoundrel and not to you, noble heart. And add, too, that Grushenka loved him only 1 hour, only one short hour she loved him. So let him remember that hour all his life. Say, Grushenka tells you to."
She ended in a voice full of sobs. The window was shut with a slam.
"Mm-hmm," growled Rakitin, laughing. "She murders your brother Mitya and then tells him to remember it all his life. What ferocity!"
Alyosha made no reply. He seemed not to have heard. He walked fast beside Rakitin as though in a terrible hurry. He was lost in thought and moved mechanically. Rakitin felt a sudden twinge, as though he'd been touched on an open wound. He had expected something quite different by bringing Grushenka and Alyosha together. Something very different from what he had hoped for had happened.
"He is a Pole, that officer of hers,"
he began again, restraining himself.
"And indeed, he's not an officer at all now. He served in the customs in Siberia, somewhere on the Chinese frontier. Some puny little beggar of a Pole, I expect. Lost his job, they say. He's heard now that Grushenka's saved a little money, so he's turned up again. That's the explanation of the mystery."
Again Alyosha seemed not to hear. Rakitin could not control himself.
"Well, so you've saved the sinner," he laughed spitefully. "Have you turned the Magdalene into the true path? Driven out the seven devils, eh? So you see, the miracles you were looking out for just now have come to pass."
"Hush, Rakitin,"
Alyosha answered with an aching heart.
"So, you despise me now for those 25 rubles. I've sold my friend, you think. But you're not Christ, you know, and I'm not Judas."
"Oh, Rakitin, I assure you I'd forgotten about it," cried Alyosha. "You remind me of it yourself."
But this was the last straw for Rakitin.
"Damnation take you all and each of you," he cried suddenly. "Why the devil did I take you up? I don't want to know you from this time forward. Go alone. There's your road."
And he turned abruptly into another street, leaving Alyosha alone in the dark. Alyosha came out of the town and walked across the fields to the monastery. Chapter 4. Cana of Galilee. It was very late, according to the monastery ideas, when Alyosha returned to the hermitage. The doorkeeper let him in by a special entrance. It had struck 9 o'clock, the hour of rest and repose after a day of such agitation for all. Alyosha timidly opened the door and went into the elder's cell, where his coffin was now standing. There was no one in the cell but Father Païssy, reading the gospel in solitude over the coffin, and the young novice, Porphyry, who, exhausted by the previous night's conversation and the disturbing incidents of the day, was sleeping the deep, sound sleep of youth on the floor of the other room. Though Father Païssy heard Alyosha come in, he did not even look in his direction. Alyosha turned to the right from the door to the corner, fell on his knees and began to pray. His soul was overflowing, but with mingled feelings. No single sensation stood out distinctly. On the contrary, one drove out another in a slow, continual rotation. But there was a sweetness in his heart, and, strange to say, Alyosha was not surprised at it. Again he saw that coffin before him, the hidden, dead figure so precious to him. But the weeping and poignant grief of the morning was no longer aching in his soul. As soon as he came in, he fell down before the coffin as before a holy shrine. But joy was glowing in his mind and in his heart. The one window of the cell was open. The air was fresh and cool.
"So the smell must have become stronger if they opened the window," thought Alyosha.
But even this thought of the smell of corruption, which had seemed to him so awful and humiliating a few hours before, no longer made him feel miserable or indignant. He began quietly praying, but he soon felt that he was praying almost mechanically. Fragments of thought floated through his soul, flashed like stars, and went out again at once, to be succeeded by others. But yet there was reigning in his soul a sense of the wholeness of things, something steadfast and comforting, and he was aware of it himself. Sometimes he began praying ardently. He longed to pour out his thankfulness and love. But when he had begun to pray, he passed suddenly to something else and sank into thought, forgetting both the prayer and what had interrupted it. He began listening to what Father Païssy was reading, but worn out with exhaustion, he gradually began to doze. "And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee," read Father Païssy, "and the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage."
"Marriage? What's that? A marriage?"
floated whirling through Alyosha's mind.
"There is happiness for her, too. She's gone to the feast. No, she's not taken the knife. That was only a tragic phrase. Well, tragic phrases should be forgiven, they must be. Tragic phrases comfort the heart. Without them, sorrow would be too heavy for men to bear. Rakitin has gone off to the back alley. As long as Rakitin broods over his wrongs, he will always go off to the back alley. But the high road, the road is wide and straight and bright as crystal, and the sun is at the end of it. Ah, what's being read?
'And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, They have no wine.'"
Alyosha heard. "Ah, yes, I was missing that, and I didn't want to miss it. I love that passage. It's Cana of Galilee, the first miracle. Ah, that miracle. Ah, that sweet miracle."
It was not men's grief, but their joy Christ visited. He worked his first miracle to help men's gladness. He who loves men loves their gladness too. He was always repeating that. It was one of his leading ideas. "There's no living without joy," Mitya says.
"Yes, Mitya."
"Everything that is true and good is always full of forgiveness."
He used to say that too.
"Jesus saith unto her, Woman, what has it to do with thee or me? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it."
Do it. Gladness. Gladness of some poor, very poor people. Of course they were poor, since they hadn't wine enough even at a wedding.
The historians write that in those days the people living about the Lake of Gennesaret were the poorest that can possibly be imagined. And another great heart, that other great being, his mother, knew that he'd come not only to make his great, terrible sacrifice. She knew that his heart was open even to the simple, artless merrymaking of some obscure and unlearned people who had warmly bidden him to their poor wedding. "Mine hour is not yet come," he said with a soft smile. He must have smiled gently to her. And indeed, was it to make wine abundant at poor weddings he had come down to earth? And yet he went, and did as she asked him.
Ah, he's reading again.
Jesus saith unto them, Fill the water pots with water, and they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, Draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast, and they bear it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, Every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, that which is worse. But thou hast kept the good wine until now.
But what's this? What's this? Why is the room growing wider? Ah, yes, it's the marriage, the wedding. Yes, of course. Here are the guests, here are the young couple sitting in the merry crowd, and where is the wise governor of the feast? But who is this? Who? Again the walls are receding. Who is getting up there from the great table? What? He? Here, too? But he's in the coffin. But he's here, too. He has stood up. He sees me. He is coming here. God!
Yes, he came up to him. To him, he, the little, thin old man with tiny wrinkles on his face, joyful and laughing softly. There was no coffin now, and he was in the same dress as he'd worn yesterday sitting with them when the visitors had gathered about him. His face was uncovered, his eyes were shining. How was this, then? He, too, had been called to the feast. He, too, at the marriage of Cana in Galilee.
Yes, my dear, I'm called, too. Called and bidden.
He heard a soft voice saying over him, Why have you hidden yourself here out of sight? You come and join us, too.
It was his voice, the voice of Father Zosima, and it must be he, since he called him.
The elder raised Alyosha by the hand, and he rose from his knees.
We are rejoicing, the little thin old man went on. We are drinking the new wine, the wine of new great gladness. Do you see how many guests? Here are the bride and bridegroom. Here is the wise governor of the feast. He is tasting the new wine. Why do you wonder at me? I gave an onion to a beggar, so I, too, am here. And many here have given only an onion each, only one little onion. What are all our deeds? And you, my gentle one, you, my kind boy, you too have known how to give a famished woman an onion today. Begin your work, dear one, begin it, gentle one. Do you see our son? Do you see him?
I'm afraid. I dare not look,
whispered Alyosha. Do not fear him. He is terrible in his greatness, awful in his sublimity, but infinitely merciful. He has made himself like unto us from love, and rejoices with us. He is changing the water into wine, that the gladness of the guests may not be cut short. He is expecting new guests. He is calling new ones unceasingly forever and ever. There they are, bringing new wine. Do you see they're bringing the vessels?
Something glowed in Alyosha's heart. Something filled it till it ached. Tears of rapture rose from his soul. He stretched out his hands, uttered a cry, and waked up. Again the coffin, the open window, and the soft, solemn, distinct reading of the gospel.
But Alyosha did not listen to the reading. It was strange, he'd fallen asleep on his knees. But now he was on his feet, and suddenly, as though thrown forward, with three firm, rapid steps he went right up to the coffin. His shoulder brushed against Father Paisi without his noticing it. Father Paisi raised his eyes for an instant from his book, but looked away again at once, seeing that something strange was happening to the boy. Alyosha gazed for half a minute at the coffin, at the covered, motionless, dead man that lay in the coffin, with the icon on his breast and the peaked cap with the octangular cross on his head. He had only just been hearing his voice, and that voice was still ringing in his ears. He was listening, still expecting other words, but suddenly he turned sharply and went out of the cell. He did not stop on the steps either, but went quickly down. His soul, overflowing with rapture, yearned for freedom, space, openness. The vault of heaven, full of soft, shining stars, stretched vast and fathomless above him. The Milky Way ran in two pale streams from the zenith to the horizon. The fresh, motionless, still night enfolded the earth. The white towers and golden domes of the cathedral gleamed out against the sapphire sky. The gorgeous autumn flowers in the beds round the house were slumbering till morning. The silence of earth seemed to melt into the silence of the heavens. The mystery of earth was one with the mystery of the stars. Alyosha stood, gazed, and suddenly threw himself down on the earth. He did not know why he embraced it. He could not have told why he longed so irresistibly to kiss it all. But he kissed it, weeping, sobbing, and watering it with his tears, and vowed passionately to love it forever and ever. Water the earth with the tears of your joy, and love those tears, echoed in his soul. What was he weeping over? Oh, in his rapture he was weeping even over those stars which were shining to him from the abyss of space, and he was not ashamed of that ecstasy. There seemed to be threads from all those innumerable worlds of God, liking his soul to them, and it was trembling all over, in contact with other worlds. He longed to forgive everyone and for everything, and to beg forgiveness. Oh, not for himself, but for all men, for all and for everything.
"And others are praying for me too," echoed again in his soul.
But with every instant he felt clearly, and as it were tangibly, that something firm and unshakable as that vault of heaven had entered into his soul. It was as though some idea had seized the sovereignty of his mind, and it was for all his life, and for ever and ever. He'd fallen on the earth a weak boy, but he rose up a resolute champion. And he knew and felt it suddenly at the very moment of his ecstasy. And never, never, all his life long, could Alyosha forget that minute.
"Someone visited my soul in that hour," he used to say afterwards, with implicit faith in his words.
Within 3 days he left the monastery in accordance with the words of his elder, who had bidden him sojourn in the world. Part 3, Book 8, Mitya. Chapter 1. Kuzma Samsonov. But Dmitri, to whom Grushenka, flying away to a new life, had left her last greetings, bidding him remember the hour of her love forever, knew nothing of what had happened to her, and was at that moment in a condition of feverish agitation and activity. For the last 2 days he had been in such an inconceivable state of mind that he might easily have fallen ill with brain fever, as he said himself afterwards. Alyosha had not been able to find him the morning before, and Ivan had not succeeded in meeting him at the tavern on the same day. The people at his lodgings, by his orders, concealed his movements. He had spent those 2 days literally rushing in all directions, struggling with his destiny and trying to save himself, as he expressed it himself afterwards, and for some hours he even made a dash out of the town on urgent business, terrible as it was to him to lose sight of Grushenka for a moment. All this was explained afterwards in detail and confirmed by documentary evidence, but for the present we will only note the most essential incidents of those 2 terrible days immediately preceding the awful catastrophe that broke so suddenly upon him. Though Grushenka had, it is true, loved him for an hour, genuinely and sincerely, yet she tortured him sometimes cruelly and mercilessly. The worst of it was that he could never tell what she meant to do. To prevail upon her by force or kindness was also impossible. She would yield to nothing. She would only have become angry and turned away from him altogether. He knew that well already. He suspected, quite correctly, that she, too, was passing through an inward struggle, and was in a state of extraordinary indecision, that she was making up her mind to something, and unable to determine upon it. And so, not without good reason, he divined, with a sinking heart, that at moments she must simply hate him and his passion. And so perhaps it was, but what was distressing Grushenka he did not understand. For him the whole tormenting question lay between him and Fyodor Pavlovich. Here we must note, by the way, one certain fact. He was firmly persuaded that Fyodor Pavlovich would offer, or perhaps had offered, Grushenka lawful wedlock, and did not for a moment believe that the old voluptuary hoped to gain his object for 3,000 rubles. Mitya had reached this conclusion from his knowledge of Grushenka and her character. That was how it was that he could believe at times that all Grushenka's uneasiness rose from not knowing which of them to choose, which was most to her advantage. Strange to say, during those days it never occurred to him to think of the approaching return of the officer, that is, of the man who had been such a fatal influence in Grushenka's life, and whose arrival she was expecting with such emotion and dread. It is true that of late Grushenka had been very silent about it. Yet he was perfectly aware of a letter she had received a month ago from her seducer, and had heard of it from her own lips. He partly knew, too, what the letter contained. In a moment of spite, Grushenka had shown him that letter, but to her astonishment he attached hardly any consequence to it. It would be hard to say why this was. Perhaps, weighed down by all the hideous horror of his struggle with his own father for this woman, he was incapable of imagining any danger more terrible, at any rate for the time. He simply did not believe in a suitor who suddenly turned up again after 5 years' disappearance, still less in his speedy arrival. Moreover, in the officer's first letter, which had been shown to Mitya, the possibility of his new rival's visit was very vaguely suggested. The letter was very indefinite, high-flown, and full of sentimentality. It must be noted that Grushenka had concealed from him the last lines of the letter in which his return was alluded to more definitely. He had, besides, noticed at that moment, he remembered afterwards, a certain involuntary proud contempt for this missive from Siberia on Grushenka's face. Grushenka told him nothing of what had passed later between her and this rival, so that by degrees he'd completely forgotten the officer's existence. He felt that whatever might come later, whatever turn things might take, his final conflict with Fyodor Pavlovich was close upon him, and must be decided before anything else. With a sinking heart, he was expecting every moment Grushenka's decision, always believing that it would come suddenly, on the impulse of the moment. All of a sudden she would say to him, "Take me, I'm yours forever," and it would all be over. He would seize her and bear her away at once to the ends of the earth. Oh, then he would bear her away at once, as far, far away as possible, to the furthest end of Russia, if not of the earth. Then he would marry her, and settle down with her incognito, so that no one would know anything about them, there, here, or anywhere. Then, oh then, a new life would begin at once. Of this different, reformed, and virtuous life, it must be virtuous, he dreamed feverishly at every moment. He thirsted for that reformation and renewal. The filthy morass in which he'd sunk of his own free will was too revolting to him, and, like very many men in such cases, he put faith above all in change of place. If only it were not for these people, if only it were not for these circumstances, if only he could fly away from this accursed place, he would be altogether regenerated, would enter on a new path. That was what he believed in, and for what he was yearning. But all this could only be on condition of the first, the happy, solution of the question. There was another possibility, a different and awful ending. Suddenly she might say to him, "Go away, I've just come to terms with Fyodor Pavlovich, I'm going to marry him and don't want you." And then, but then. But Mitya did not know what would happen then. Up to the last hour he didn't know. That must be said to his credit. He had no definite intentions, had planned no crime. He was simply watching and spying in agony, while he prepared himself for the first happy solution of his destiny. He drove away any other idea, in fact. But for that ending, a quite different anxiety arose. A new, incidental, but yet fatal and insoluble difficulty presented itself. If she were to say to him, "I'm yours, take me away," how could he take her away? Where had he the means, the money, to do it? It was just at this time that all sources of revenue from Fyodor Pavlovich, doles which had gone on without interruption for so many years, ceased. Grushenka had money, of course, But with regard to this, Mitya suddenly evinced extraordinary pride. He wanted to carry her away and begin the new life with her himself at his own expense, not at hers. He could not conceive of taking her money, and the very idea caused him a pang of intense repulsion. I won't enlarge on this fact or analyze it here, but confine myself to remarking that this was his attitude at the moment. All this may have arisen indirectly and unconsciously from the secret stings of his conscience for the money of Katerina Ivanovna that he had dishonestly appropriated. I've been a scoundrel to one of them, and I shall be a scoundrel again to the other directly. With his feeling then, as he explained after, and when Grushenka knows she won't care for such a scoundrel. Where, then, was he to get the means? Where was he to get the fateful money? Without it, all would be lost, and nothing could be done. And only because I hadn't the money. Oh, the shame of it! To anticipate things, he did, perhaps, know where to get the money, knew, perhaps, where it lay at that moment. I will say no more of this here, as it will all be clear later. But his chief trouble, I must explain, however obscurely, lay in the fact that to have the sum he knew of, to have the right to take it, he must first restore Katerina Ivanovna's 3,000. If not, I'm a common pickpocket, I'm a scoundrel, and I don't want to begin a new life as a scoundrel, Mitya decided. And so he made up his mind to move heaven and earth to return Katerina Ivanovna that 3,000, and that first of all. The final stage of this decision, so to say, had been reached only during the last hours, that is, after his last interview with Alyosha 2 days before, on the high road, on the evening when Grushenka had insulted Katerina Ivanovna, and Mitya, after hearing Alyosha's account of it, had admitted that he was a scoundrel, and told him to tell Katerina Ivanovna so, if it could be any comfort to her. After parting from his brother on that night, he had felt in his frenzy that it would be better to murder and rob someone than fail to pay my debt to Katya. I'd rather everyone thought me a robber and a murderer. I'd rather go to Siberia than that Katya should have the right to say that I deceived her and stole her money, and used her money to run away with Grushenka and begin a new life. That I can't do. So Mitya decided, grinding his teeth. And he might well fancy at times that his brain would give way. But meanwhile he went on struggling. Strange to say, though one would have supposed there was nothing left for him but despair, for what chance had he with nothing in the world to raise such a sum? Yet, to the very end he persisted in hoping that he would get that 3,000, that the money would somehow come to him, of itself, as though it might drop from heaven. That is just how it is with people who, like Dmitri, have never had anything to do with money, except to squander what had come to them by inheritance, without any effort of their own, and have no notion how money is obtained. A whirl of the most fantastic notions took possession of his brain, immediately after he'd parted with Alyosha 2 days before, and threw his thoughts into a tangle of confusion. This is how it was he pitched first on a perfectly wild enterprise. And, perhaps, to men of that kind in such circumstances, the most impossible, fantastic schemes occur first, and seem most practical. He suddenly determined to go to Samsonov, the merchant who was Grushenka's protector, and to propose a scheme to him, and by means of it to obtain from him at once the whole of the sum required. Of the commercial value of his scheme he had no doubt, not the slightest, and was only uncertain how Samsonov would look upon his freak, supposing he were to consider it from any but the commercial point of view. Though Mitya knew the merchant by sight, he was not acquainted with him, and had never spoken a word to him. But for some unknown reason he had long entertained the conviction that the old reprobate, who was lying at death's door, would perhaps not at all object now to Grushenka's securing a respectable position, and marrying a man to be depended upon. And he believed not only that he would not object, but that this was what he desired, and if opportunity arose, that he would be ready to help. From some rumour, or perhaps from some stray words of Grushenka's, He had gathered further that the old man would perhaps prefer him to Fyodor Pavlovich for Grushenka. Possibly many of the readers of my novel will feel that in reckoning on such assistance, and being ready to take his bride, so to speak, from the hands of her protector, Dmitri showed great coarseness and want of delicacy. I will only observe that Mitya looked upon Grushenka's past as something completely over. He looked on that past with infinite pity, and resolved with all the fervour of his passion, that when once Grushenka told him she loved him and would marry him, it would mean the beginning of a new Grushenka and a new Dmitri, free from every vice. They would forgive one another and would begin their lives afresh. As for Kuzma Samsonov, Dmitri looked upon him as a man who had exercised a fateful influence in that remote past of Grushenka's, though she had never loved him, and who was now himself a thing of the past, completely done with and, so to say, non-existent. Besides, Mitya hardly looked upon him as a man at all, for it was known to everyone in the town that he was only a shattered wreck, whose relations with Grushenka had changed their character and were now simply paternal, and that this had been so for a long time. In any case, there was much simplicity on Mitya's part in all this, for in spite of all his vices, he was a very simple-hearted man. It was an instance of this simplicity that Mitya was seriously persuaded that, being on the eve of his departure for the next world, old Kuzma must sincerely repent of his past relations with Grushenka, and that she had no more devoted friend and protector in the world than this now harmless old man. After his conversation with Alyosha at the crossroads, he hardly slept all night, and at 10 o'clock next morning he was at the house of Samsonov and telling the servant to announce him. It was a very large and gloomy old house of two stories, with a lodge and outhouses. In the lower story lived Samsonov's two married sons with their families, his old sister and his unmarried daughter. In the lodge lived two of his clerks, one of whom also had a large family. Both the lodge and the lower story were overcrowded, but the old man kept the upper floor to himself, and would not even let the daughter live there with him, though she waited upon him, and in spite of her asthma was obliged at certain fixed hours, and at any time he might call her, to run upstairs to him from below. This upper floor contained a number of large rooms kept purely for show, furnished in the old-fashioned merchant style, with long, monotonous rows of clumsy mahogany chairs along the walls, with glass chandeliers under shades, and gloomy mirrors on the walls. All these rooms were entirely empty and unused, but the old man kept to one room, a small, remote bedroom, where he was waited upon by an old servant with a kerchief on her head, and by a lad who used to sit on the locker in the passage. Owing to his swollen legs, the old man could hardly walk at all, and was only rarely lifted from his leather armchair, when the old woman supporting him led him up and down the room once or twice. He was morose and taciturn even with this old woman. When he was informed of the arrival of the captain, he at once refused to see him, but Mitya persisted and sent his name up again. Samsonov questioned the lad minutely. What he looked like, whether he was drunk, was he going to make a row? The answer he received was that he was sober, but wouldn't go away. The old man again refused to see him. Then Mitya, who had foreseen this and purposely brought pencil and paper with him, wrote clearly on the piece of paper the words, "On most important business closely concerning Agrafena Alexandrovna," and sent it up to the old man. After thinking a little, Samsonov told the lad to take the visitor to the drawing-room, and sent the old woman downstairs with a summons to his younger son to come upstairs to him at once. The younger son, a man over 6 foot, and of exceptional physical strength, who was closely shaven and dressed in the European style, though his father still wore a caftan and a beard, came at once without a comment. All the family trembled before the father. The old man had sent for this giant, not because he was afraid of the captain, he was by no means of a timorous temper, but in order to have a witness in case of an emergency. Supported by his son and the servant lad, he waddled at last into the drawing-room. It may be assumed that he felt considerable curiosity. The drawing-room in which Mitya was awaiting him was a vast, dreary room that laid a weight of depression on the heart. It had a double row of windows, a gallery, marbled walls, and three immense chandeliers with glass lustres covered with shades. Mitya was sitting on a little chair at the entrance, awaiting his fate with nervous impatience. When the old man appeared at the opposite door, 70 feet away, Mitya jumped up at once, and with his long military stride, walked to meet him. Mitya was well dressed, in a frock coat, buttoned up, with a round hat and black gloves in his hands, just as he had been 3 days before at the elders, at the family meeting with his father and brothers. The old man waited for him, standing, dignified and unbending, and Mitya felt at once that he had looked him through and through as he advanced. Mitya was greatly impressed, too, with Samsonov's immensely swollen face. His lower lip, which had always been thick, hung down now, looking like a bun. He bowed to his guest in dignified silence, motioned him to a low chair by the sofa, and leaning on his son's arm, he began lowering himself onto the sofa opposite, groaning painfully, so that Mitya, seeing his painful exertions, immediately felt remorseful and sensitively conscious of his insignificance in the presence of the dignified person he had ventured to disturb.
"What is it you want of me, sir?"
said the old man, deliberately, distinctly, severely, but courteously, when he was at last seated. Mitya started, leapt up, but sat down again. Then he began at once speaking with loud, nervous haste, gesticulating, and in a positive frenzy. He was unmistakably a man driven into a corner, on the brink of ruin, catching at the last straw, ready to sink if he failed. Old Samsonov probably grasped all this in an instant, though his face remained cold and immovable as a statue's.
"Most honoured sir, Kuzma Kuzmich, you have no doubt heard more than once of my dispute with my father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, who robbed me of my inheritance from my mother, seeing the whole town is gossiping about it. For here, everyone's gossiping of what they shouldn't. And besides, it might have reached through Grishenka. I beg your pardon, through Agrafena Alexandrovna. Agrafena Alexandrovna, the lady for whom I have the highest respect and esteem."
The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. This book was first published in Russia in 1880. This unabridged recording of The Brothers Karamazov was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Frederick Davidson. This book is 940 pages long. The book is preceded by a quotation from the Bible. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." From the Gospel according to St. John, 12:24. The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1, Book 1, The History of a Family. Chapter 1. Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov was the third son of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, a landowner well known in our district in his own day, and still remembered among us owing to his gloomy and tragic death, which happened 13 years ago, and which I shall describe in its proper place. For the present I will only say that this landowner, for so we used to call him, although he hardly spent a day of his life on his own estate, was a strange type, yet one pretty frequently to be met with, a type abject and vicious, and at the same time senseless. But he was one of those senseless persons who are very well capable of looking after their worldly affairs, and apparently after nothing else. Fyodor Pavlovich, for instance, began with next to nothing. His estate was of the smallest. He ran to dine at other men's tables, and fastened on them as a toady. Yet at his death it appeared that he had 100,000 rubles in hard cash. At the same time, he was all his life one of the most senseless, fantastical fellows in the whole district. I repeat, it was not stupidity. The majority of these fantastical fellows are shrewd and intelligent enough, but just senselessness, and a peculiar national form of it. He was married twice, and had 3 sons, the eldest Dmitri by his first wife, and 2, Ivan and Alexei, by his second. Fyodor Pavlovich's first wife, Adelaida Ivanovna, belonged to a fairly rich and distinguished noble family, also landowners in our district, the Miusovs. How it came to pass that an heiress, who was also a beauty, and moreover one of those vigorous, intelligent girls, so common in this generation, but sometimes also to be found in the last, could have married such a worthless, puny weakling, as we all called him, I won't attempt to explain. I knew a young lady of the last romantic generation, who, after some years of an enigmatic passion for a gentleman, whom she might quite easily have married at any moment, invented insuperable obstacles to their union, and ended by throwing herself one stormy night into a rather deep and rapid river from a high bank, almost a precipice, and so perished, entirely to satisfy her own caprice and to be like Shakespeare's Ophelia. Indeed, if this precipice, a chosen and favourite spot of hers, had been less picturesque, if there had been a prosaic flat bank in its place, most likely the suicide would never have taken place. This is a fact, and probably there have been not a few similar instances in the last 2 or 3 generations. Adelaida Ivanovna Miusov's action was similarly, no doubt, an echo of other people's ideas, and was due to the irritation caused by lack of mental freedom. She wanted perhaps to show her feminine independence, to override class distinctions and the despotism of her family. And a pliable imagination persuaded her, we must suppose, for a brief moment, that Fyodor Pavlovich, in spite of his parasitic position, was one of the bold and ironical spirits of that progressive epoch, though he was, in fact, an ill-natured buffoon and nothing more. What gave the marriage piquancy was that it was preceded by an elopement, and this greatly captivated Adelaida Ivanovna's fancy. Fyodor Pavlovich's position at the time made him specially eager for any such enterprise, for he was passionately anxious to make a career in one way or another. To attach himself to a good family and obtain a dowry was an alluring prospect. As for mutual love, it did not exist, apparently, either in the bride or in him, in spite of Adelaida Ivanovna's beauty. This was perhaps a unique case of the kind in the life of Fyodor Pavlovich, who was always of a voluptuous temper, and ready to run after any petticoat on the slightest encouragement. She seems to have been the only woman who made no particular appeal to his senses. Immediately after the elopement, Adelaida Ivanovna discerned in a flash that she had no feeling for her husband but contempt. The marriage accordingly showed itself in its true colours, with extraordinary rapidity. Although the family accepted the event pretty quickly and apportioned the runaway bride her dowry, the husband and wife began to lead a most disorderly life, and there were everlasting scenes between them. It was said that the young wife showed incomparably more generosity and dignity than Fyodor Pavlovich, who, as is now known, got hold of all her money, up to 25,000 rubles, as soon as she received it, so that those thousands were lost to her forever. The little village and the rather fine town house which formed part of her dowry he did the utmost for a long time to transfer to his name, by means of some deed of conveyance. He would probably have succeeded, merely from her moral fatigue and desire to get rid of him, and from the contempt and loathing he aroused by his persistent and shameless importunity. But fortunately, Adelaida Ivanovna's family intervened and circumvented his greediness. It is known for a fact that frequent fights took place between the husband and wife, but rumour had it that Fyodor Pavlovich did not beat his wife, but was beaten by her, for she was a hot-tempered, bold, dark-browed, impatient woman, possessed of remarkable physical strength. Finally, she left the house and ran away from Fyodor Pavlovich with a destitute divinity student, leaving Mitya, a child of 3 years old, in her husband's hands. Immediately, Fyodor Pavlovich introduced a regular harem into the house and abandoned himself to orgies of drunkenness. In the intervals, he used to drive all over the province, complaining tearfully to each and all of Adelaida Ivanovna's having left him, going into details too disgraceful for a husband to mention in regard to his own married life. What seemed to gratify him and flatter his self-love most was to play the ridiculous part of the injured husband, and to parade his woes with embellishments. "One would think that you've got a promotion, Fyodor Pavlovich, you seem so pleased in spite of your sorrow," scoffers said to him. Many even added that he was glad of a new comic part in which to play the buffoon, and that it was simply to make it funnier that he pretended to be unaware of his ludicrous position. But, who knows, it may have been simplicity. At last he succeeded in getting on the track of his runaway wife. The poor woman turned out to be in Petersburg, where she'd gone with her divinity student, and where she'd thrown herself into a life of complete emancipation. Fyodor Pavlovich at once began bustling about, making preparations to go to Petersburg. With what object he could not himself have said. He would perhaps have really gone, but having determined to do so, he felt at once entitled to fortify himself for the journey by another bout of reckless drinking. And just at that time his wife's family received the news of her death in Petersburg. She had died quite suddenly in a garret, according to one story, of typhus, or as another version had it, of starvation. Fyodor Pavlovich was drunk when he heard of his wife's death, and the story is that he ran out into the street and began shouting with joy, raising his hands to heaven, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." But others say he wept without restraint like a little child, so much so that people were sorry for him, in spite of the repulsion he inspired. It is quite possible that both versions were true, that he rejoiced at his release, and at the same time wept for her who released him. As a general rule, people, even the wicked, are much more naive and simple-hearted than we suppose. And we ourselves are, too.